Sorry, is it for me? What?
Yes, Mr. Hero, I'm addressing you, sir.
Yeah, okay, certainly. I think, you know, there are long-term reasons and the very short-term reasons. The long-term reason is, of course, Kashmir. Kashmir problem is 61 years old, and it came about when there was the independence and partition of the Indian subcontinent when the British left in 1947. And now, of course, that particular problem goes up and down, but it really, again, took off after 1989, that is, after the Soviets left Afghanistan, those Mujahideen who were very much against the Soviet Union and along working with the Pakistanis and the CIA to get the Soviets out, then they looked for another place for jihad, and Kashmir was the place where they would argue that the Muslim majority is being oppressed by the Hindu majority from Delhi. And so that's an ongoing thing, and that is, you know, sometimes it's very hot, sometimes it cools down. And much more recently, another incident which has nothing to do with Kashmir. In 1992, one mosque built by Emperor Babur in the early 16th century was destroyed by Hindu extremists who said this mosque was built on an old site of their own god, Lord Rama.
The Sikhs, that is that correct, sir? The Sikhs?
In 1992,
the Hindus, okay.
That particular mosque was destroyed, you know, by okay. the Hindu extremists. And see, and that created a problem because Muslims protested, and then Muslims were attacked in Mumbai in late 1992, and up to 1,000 Muslims were killed by Hindu extremists. And then next year, 93, there were bombings in Mumbai in which about 200 people were killed. And then another incident in 2006. So I think that I'm saying one is the long-term Kashmir problem, which is quite a large international problem. The other one is national, which has nothing to do with Kashmir, and it started in 1992 because of the what's called Babri, means Babur, a mosque built by the Emperor Babur, you know. And so two things are interlinked.
Okay, that's quite unequivocal. Now, Zaid Hamid, allegations abound so far as incriminating Islamabad is concerned, but there seems to be scant evidence being adduced to corroborate that. Now, am I mistaken?
You're absolutely correct. You see, there is absolutely no evidence as yet, or nor there is going to be any, to incriminate Islamabad for these Mumbai incidents. I would urge our listeners to concentrate on one very interesting fact, which is not being mentioned in the international media. That is that before this Mumbai incident, India was in turmoil internally because Indian police had unearthed and was investigating a massive terrorism campaign in India, which was orchestrated by Indian military intelligence and the Hindu Zionist extremists for creating violence and terror in India. Even the train bombing, the train which runs between India and Pakistan, when it was bombed a few years ago, killing dozens of Pakistanis, was blamed on Lashkar-e-Taiba. But Indian police had arrested a serving Indian military intelligence officer, Colonel Prohit. And the links were going to BJP and all other Zionist Hindu organizations like RSS, Bajrangdal, and
Hamid,
BJP.
I want to interject there. Do forgive the interruption. Now, you brought up Zionists twice. Now, I want to ask you, what kind of a role does Zionism play there?
You see, this is where the nexus between the Hindu extremists and Mossad and the Israelis is very, very active. The interest of Israel and Indian extremists is identical against Pakistan as well as against Iran.
On that sensitive note, I want to get a reaction from London. Now, Dilipiro, now, what are your thoughts there? And throw in a challenge. Is there an external involvement from the Zionist camp, if any?
I think the basic one has to understand also, you know, that one has to be a little bit more specific. To say BJP and extremist terrorists, I'm afraid the BJP is a mainstream political party. They were in power for six, 7 years. It was during the BJP period that a Muslim, Abul Kalam, was elected president of India. So let's not, you know, confuse the, of course, BJP is Hindu nationalist or you know, right of center party, but you know, it's not the same as the ones who are extremists. Like, if you want to talk about that, it's called Shiv Sena, which is a small group based in Mumbai and Maharashtra. Now, in terms of Zionists, see, this is the basic situation, i.e., when there is an attack, you know, terrorist attack, and if for some reason or for some historical reason, whatever, Islamicists are involved, not Islamic people, Islamicists, those who believe in using violence for religious or political purposes, and then there tends to be the, shall I say, tendency to go to some other country which had a similar problem and learn from them. So after this Kashmir problem became quite, shall I say, strong after 89, then yes, the Indian government actually has a very close relationship, and those relationships only were built properly after Oslo in 1993, proper diplomatic relations. Yes, therefore they try to get, shall I say, their expertise on intelligence. And again, from that point of view, you can look at Sri Lanka. Now, Sri Lanka, they have problems, mm-hmm. Tamil you know, insurgents, and they have done the same thing. They try to get expertise from Israel to see how they can tackle their terrorism. So in that sense, yes, from between India and Israel, there is this cooperation. And of course, you can say the same between India and USA.
Okay, Dilip, I'm still addressing you. I want to pick you up on that notion of the damaged relations between Pakistan and India. The history is pretty long. You know better than anyone else. But my question would be, under the present circumstances, when the peace talks and the peace process was taking its natural course, and this seems to be doing only as much as derailing it, now, which party, internal or external, would be benefiting most from this basically collapse of a peace talk between the two rival and neighboring nuclear countries?
Yeah, I think the main difference that has happened is quite obvious. Since February, when the civilian government was put in power in Pakistan, and then, of course, in September, we had Asif Zardari becoming the president, and Asif Zardari made very, shall I say, peaceful statements about India, and he called those people who are insurgents in Kashmir as terrorists, not freedom fighters, and he got a lot of backlash at home and also from the military. And so, yes, therefore, you know, some kind of expectation was there that the relations would improve. So that's a very big change. And therefore, one might say there would be some elements on both sides of the border who would not like this to happen. And on that particular thing, of course, there are two organizations. I mean, it's quite widely known. It's all over in books and articles and so on, so forth. In 1989, the Pakistani Inter-Service Intelligence, ISI, set up two organizations, Jaish-e-Mohammed and Lashkar-e-Taiba, and, you know, to encourage freedom fighters within Kashmir. It's quite well known. In fact, Musharraf was in charge of setting that thing up. Now, things have changed since then, and after 9/11, under pressure from the USA, Musharraf banned Lashkar-e-Taiba, and so they renamed themselves as Jamaat-e al-Dawa. And of course, their leader lives very near Lahore, Murtakai, and of course, it is said, according to this one particular terrorist who attacked and whose statements the Indians are releasing, he said they were trained by Lashkar-e-Taiba, not within Kashmir, not within Pakistan proper, in the Pakistan-administered Kashmir, and that they had a training on Mangla Dam, which is a very large dam, in amphibious exercises. Nobody's saying that the Pakistani government is involved.
Okay, that's a pretty good point you brought up. I want to go to Islamabad now. As Dilipiro substantiated that, the truth appears to be that no one's basically pointing the finger directly at the Zardari government or the Islamabad presidential palace just yet. But then again, bringing up the issue of ISI being a part of the government and the system ruling in Pakistan seems to be implicating them in a vague way. Now, my question to you is, Mr. Hamid, now, is there an involvement between ISI and the rogue, let's say, militant groups there? And if there is, why doesn't anyone basically come forth and divulge and disclose that?
First, I would like to make two statements. Number one, Mr. Hero had said about the BJP, BJP being a mainstream party and not a terrorist organization. Despite being a political party, their role in massacre of Gujarat Muslims in 2002, the most ruthless slaughter of Muslims of the 21st century, is open to all. Narendra Modi is a BJP-appointed chief minister. He has been declared a terrorist, refused a visa in the United States for his crimes. So their role in terror against Muslims is obvious. Number two, first, let's discuss the role of Colonel Prohit and the Indian military intelligence in orchestrating terrorism inside India and arranging these acts of terror which were blamed on Lashkar-e-Taiba and ISI. Why not anybody discussing that? And Colonel Prohit and his military intelligence associates.
I want you to kindly hang on there and proceed by differentiating the implications that have been that are being attributed to Lashkar-e-Taiba, the LET, and differentiate that from whatever is being said about ISI, because you just haven't responded to my initial query whether or not there is a connection between the two. Now, is there one?
There is absolutely rubbish. Lashkar-e-Taiba.
So there is no connection between the two whatsoever. Okay, proceed.
The Lashkar-e-Taiba is absolutely not involved in this Mumbai affair. Lashkar-e-Taiba operates in Kashmir, yes. Line of control, it's not an international border. For 50 years,
okay.
It's an absolutely
disputed territory.
On that note,
I want to get a rebuttal, a reaction, Dilipiro. So you heard the other gentleman, no connections. Yeah. What's your response?
Yeah, I think, you see, again, you know, what has been said, and I'm just going by the published statements, that, you know, an ex-officer trained these terrorists. Now, it's an ex-officer. Now, suppose I work for ISI, or you work for ISI, or you work for Indian military or U.S. military, and when you retire, the military is now responsible for what you do. So I think that it's not difficult, and this happens all the time. Of course, you can see what happened to the USA, what are the rogue elements involved. And so, yes, in terms of giving training, you don't have to have a serving officer do that.
Dilipiro, I want to expedite matters, if I may. Sorry for the interjection. Now, you brought up the U.S. Now, I want to ask from both of you, but first beginning with you. Now, is there a U.S. involvement here in any way? After all, the U.S. Top diplomat, Condoleezza Rice, just visited both countries, and she supposedly had a mission. I'd like you to amplify there. But it seems like at least the local U.S. mainstream media are taking advantage, seizing this opportunity, this bleak and very dreadful opportunity of the Mumbai attacks, as yet another excuse to scare the people inside America out of their wits in order to perhaps, this is a conjectural notion espoused by many analysts, to further and extend the so-called war on terror beyond the Obama administration and well into the South Asian and Indian subcontinent. Now, what's your thoughts there?
Yes, I think you see what really happens with, you know, quite straightforward, i.e. if there is a particular country or a society or a city which suffers or becomes victim of terrorist attacks, then certainly there is the public opinion, and of course there are, shall I say, international elements who would like to take advantage of that. You see, and again, if you go back, it's not only that it's happened to India or happened to USA. Remember what happened in Russia when there was this attack on the children's school. So at that moment, those countries which suffer this, they come together, but that doesn't mean that they're actually having some kind of a grand alliance. That's one. Secondly, whenever something like this happens, two things happen. One is, oh, we told them, and they didn't pay attention. You can see this, you know, if we're talking 9/11, it was said that the CIA had information in early August, which Mr. Bush did not read because he was relaxing and cutting brush at Crawford, his ranch. You see, same thing, Madrid, we were told the same thing. Some information was there before. What happened in London, 7th of July, same thing. So this always happens, you see. So ultimately, it isn't like there's a grand plan and USA is sitting around to say, let's embrace India much more. No, when this happens, naturally, there is a reaction. And also, remember one important factor. India is a democratic country, for better or worse. Therefore, there is a governing party, a governing coalition, and there is the opposition. And opposition takes advantage of any problem that the governing party has, because quite soon they're going to be
elections. Dilip, if I can ask you to kindly hang on to your thoughts on that trail. Now, Zaid Hamid, what are your thoughts there? Now, is there a U.S. connection at all?
The U.S. connection in orchestrating this act in Mumbai, no, I don't think so. There is a very strong Israeli connection, all right. Israel and RAW coordinate together to create a justification to wage a war against the state of Pakistan. The Americans are not directly involved, but now they are definitely coming in to help the Indians in a diplomatic manner, because President Obama has also been saying that they would be waging a war in the tribal areas of Pakistan when he takes charge. And Indians would definitely be looking at those statements with great interest. And they would be trying to link up their strategy against Pakistan with the Obama strategy in the tribal areas, sandwiching Pakistan from both the sides. So Americans directly as such in orchestrating this act, no. Diplomatically now exploiting the opportunity to squeeze Pakistan from both sides, yes. But we must also keep this in mind.
How do you foresee the future of Pakistan-Indian relations under the present circumstances?
There is absolutely no future of peace talks under the present circumstances. The hostilities will grow if the Indians maintain their aggressive posture against Islamabad, against Pakistan, threaten to use a preemptive strike on the refugee camps in the Kashmir or Pakistani areas. And if President Obama also increases his pressure in the tribal areas of Pakistan after he takes charge, Pakistan would actually be facing itself against Indians as well as the Americans on the Western Front. In the future, I see hostilities and not so much of peace initiative.
Okay.
The environment has gone very bitter.
Crystal clear there, Zaid. I'm going to hopefully get back to you now. Dilip Hiro, apparently the Chinese government have a call for the resumption of peace talks between Pakistan and India. Now, what kind of an interest or role could Beijing have here?
Certainly, I think the Chinese, you know, have a big headline, what they call peaceful rise. That is, you know, they themselves are coming up, but they want peace and security everywhere. They don't want to create problems. And see, in terms of India-Pakistan relations, I honestly don't think that India is going to do anything, you know, overt or go in and say, shall I say, in court, take over or destroy the training camps if they exist at all in the Pakistani administered Kashmir. But at the same time, see, this is something always to keep in mind. It's a democratic country, and people have opinions and public opinion. There's a press, independent press. And if you are a party in power, if something like this happens, it looks bad for you. Elections are coming up in May. And so you have to make big noises. Yes, yes, yes. But you see, at the same time, you have to keep calm and try to allow the situation to calm down and try to have dialogue with Asif Zardari, who seems to be quite serious. Now, in Pakistan, there's a major problem. That is, the present civilian government is quite weak. It doesn't have full control. Of course, it's widely known that the military does not like Asif Zardari. They did not like when he talked about insurgents in Kashmir being terrorists and not freedom fighters. So you see, and in a way, you might say that he is being
over-hasty. You made a very effective point there, Dilip Hiro. Now, briefly, and we only got less than a minute left, to Islamabad. Now, have the media done the incident sufficient justice in covering it? I'm referring to the mainstream media in the West.
Pakistani media, for the first time.
Mr. Zaid, please. Quickly, go ahead.
Yes, Pakistani media, after a very long time, got its acts together and fiercely counterattacked the Indian media to that extent that Indian media was actually surprised at the unity which the Pakistani media showed, because Pakistanis did not take it lying down this time, massively counterattacked, and actually put the Indian media on defensive. And the media's role this time has been more aggressive. Both sides fought each other bitter battles. And basically,
okay, gentlemen, I think we're going to have to leave it here because we're just out of time, and this marks the finale. A big thank you to the panel for appearing as guests and to you for staying on board and watching. Don't forget to visit our website for further in-depth coverage. In case you have any criticisms at all, why don't you send us an email? The address is right there on the screen. But this show, Four Corners, will return tomorrow. And until then, it's goodbye from me, Zubin Zarvan.